Hello, friends. Adam Benson here.
And I'm Amy Stewart.
And this is On Call.
Stories and conversations on calling.
Today, we are excited about interviewing the Reverend Dr. Willie Jennings. Dr. Jennings was a professor at Duke Divinity School for a season where he served as academic dean and professor of theology, and now teaches at Yale Divinity School. He has published works including Christian Imagination, an Acts Commentary, and Education After Whiteness. And we are excited to talk with him today about his call and about our collective call as Christians and as humans, and how we confront racism in ourselves, in our churches, in the world. And so we're glad that you're able to join us today. Friends, welcome back to On Call, Stories and Conversations on Calling. Today, we are so excited and grateful to have with us Dr. Willie Jennings, who is a professor at Yale Divinity School. Dr. Jennings, thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
Glad to be here with you.
I thought we would start off with, you know, when I was trying to think of questions to ask you, I was kind of wondering what kind of questions you would have had growing up. And I believe Grand Rapids, Michigan, when you were younger, around faith and race. Since we've asked you to come here today to talk to us about faith and our call to confront racism, and did the questions you have as a kid evolve into a sense of calling to minister and to teach? And I was wondering if you could just describe what that was like for you.
Absolutely. So I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which we used to say is the most theological town in America, because Grand Rapids has, as most people know, those three, actually four, major Christian publishers. There's Erdmann's, there's Zondervan, Zondervan Publishing Company comes out of Grand Rapids. There's Baker, Baker Bookhouse, and Baker Academic that both come out of Grand Rapids. And then there's a smaller press named Kriegel Press that also came out of Grand Rapids. And so those four presses came out of Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids was also the home of a very famous radio Bible hour that broadcast across the country. And it was the home of a denomination, the Christian Reformed Church. And there were Christian Reformed churches almost on every block in Grand Rapids. Not only the Christian Reformed Church, but the Reformed Church of America had churches in Grand Rapids. Two Dutch immigrant Reformed denominations that flourished in Western Michigan. And in Grand Rapids, there were churches from every denomination, every walk. We had Jehovah's Witnesses. We also had Muslims. We had Muslims and other people who were also in Rapids. So I was born and raised into a Christian world, an intense Christian world. And that meant that the church and Christianity were always in front of me, not only as a backdrop, but also the context within which all my questions formed. Why Christianity? Why are we spending every weekend and every waking moment of the weekend in church? And so grew up in Grand Rapids, what you knew is that Christianity mattered and theology mattered. And so it was commonplace that most people went to church on Sunday morning and Sunday night. And Sunday afternoon, you were doing something related to the church as well. And it was the case that conversations, theological conversations about Christianity and the church were just a part of the air, part of the water you drink, part of everything. And so I was raised in an intensely Christian context. As I always tell people, if you're in Grand Rapids, it doesn't matter what denomination you are, you're Reformed because it was in the air. And what that meant was that you were brought very early into, in a sense, the overwhelming power of Christianity to shape people's lives and to shape the way they did things. But very early, I started asking kind of fundamental questions, first to myself and then to everyone around me. Hey, this is before I had my teenage years, as a very young man. They're asking questions about the segregated nature of the church in Grand Rapids. White churches and black churches were separated. And what was also the case is that growing up in Grand Rapids, you know, you were also a part of a reality of redlining where black people were allowed to live and not allowed to live. And you were also, as I got older and into my teen years, I realized that I was in a very, very incredibly racist place. Not only was there the black-white antagonism that was so much a part of life in Grand Rapids, but as also part of life in America, but there was deep hatred between the other ethnic groups. You know, if you were Dutch, you know, you really didn't get along with the Polish people, who didn't get along with the Italian people, who didn't get along with, you name it. I mean, so there were always didn't get along with the Germans who were present, and so you had these deep racial and sometimes ethnic, but mostly racial tensions. And so for me, the first crucial question that drove me forward was, how can I be in a place that is so intensely Christian and at the same time so intensely racist? I could not get my mind around that. How can you have people, and we're talking about, these are not nominal Christians. They knew the Bible. They knew the creeds. They knew the confessions. They were theologically astute. And yet this was an incredibly racist place. And I could not get my mind around that. And no one I talked to could give me any adequate answers for this fundamental contradiction in life that I was seeing. And so that drove me forward. That was really the driving question forward, that I was inside of a Christianity that was in a fundamental way circumscribed by race and shaped inside these geographic and class dynamics of segregation. And I could not understand that if Christianity is about the God who created all and the God who has power, why was that power and that God's love so constrained and circumscribed by these racial and geographic dynamics? And so it made no sense to me. So in a sense, I was trying all my young life to make sense of Christianity. I was the kind of kid in my church, my pastor, my poor pastor now, blessed memory, he used to hate to see me coming because I was always that kid who would raise his hand and say, you know, what you said today contradicts what you said in the sermon last week. And, you know, but, and I don't, does this passage actually mean what you just said? I was a precocious, troublemaking kid who was just constantly asking questions that he could not answer. He could not answer to save his life. And so that really pressed me forward. My earliest sense of calling was deeply embedded in those questions. And a deeply embedded in frustration. In fact, I would have to say that my calling was really shaped inside frustration and questioning. I believed in the faith. And for me, there was just no other option. I mean, I never imagined myself inside something that was false because I knew it was real. But I also knew that because it's real, this didn't make any sense. And so the question became for me, does Christianity, does the gospel have the power to actually change people? And so I was drawn to college, really not so much looking toward a particular kind of vocation or field. I mean, I didn't go to college because I wanted to be an architect or a doctor or a lawyer. You know, at first I loved music, so I was thinking about studying music, but what I really wanted to get was answers to these questions. Okay. And so I went to a Christian college. And so when I got there, I said to the admissions director, now another gentleman of blessed memory, I don't recall his name, he's an older gentleman. I said, you know, I'm thinking about coming to this college. I just want to take a few courses in Bible, see if I can understand some things. Can you guys help me with that? He said, yeah, Mr. James, we can help you take a few Bible courses and a few other things if you like. I said, okay, good, good. So that really propelled me. And then when I got into college, I realized that I was bringing a wild animal that was completely undomesticated. That is, I was bringing my questions and my frustrations that at Calvin and then in my graduate school education, no one can handle. no one gave me the answers looking for in this very basic question that started when I was a preteen. Why is Christianity unable to challenge what later on we would call the racial condition of the world? And what that meant for me is that two things were emerging for me as I was going through my education. One, that researching and thinking through this question would shape my life. And two, that I really wanted to be in the academy. I loved to be in the context where thinking and teaching and talking and freedom were a part of matters. And so what emerged for me is the full sense of my calling as a professor and the full sense of the questions that were going to propel me to try to understand how Christianity and race are intertwined. And what I slowly began to realize, and none of my teachers could help me, is that race and Christianity are bound together.
Well, thank you. Would you say that your works, The Christian Imagination, is sort of your like explanation of like how this came to be?
Right.
And then your Acts commentary is, what do we do about it? Or this is what God is calling us, what do we do about it? And then maybe your book, Education After Whiteness, is how this came to be and what we're supposed to do about it in academic institutions.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. You know, I knew with the first one that I was trying to help people see what none of my professors saw. And then after that, I've been trying to think about not only what do we do about it, but to understand the depth of the problem. And in some ways, I'm still trying to put on the table for people the depth of the problem. For too many people, they don't understand that it's not just a matter of people not liking one another, people not getting along. It reaches all the way down to the bone and the dirt, as I like to say, and trying to give people a sense of how far down the problem goes so that they can then start to dig beneath it, unearth it, and then plant something different. That, for me, was the, and continues to be the driving force of my scholarship and my writing, to try, at the end of the day, to help people see what in many ways has, it's in front of us, but it's in front of us in such a way that we've been blinded by it, or it's camouflaged. So we're looking at it, but we don't even see what we're looking at.
Or how do we as Christians, as ministers and lay folks in the church, how do we put on the glasses to see the depth of the problem? And for churches that are wanting to get involved and do this, but they don't know where to start, to begin putting those glasses on and seeing the depth of the problem and what we're supposed to do about it, where would you encourage churches to begin doing that learning or that educational work, and how to really see into the depth of this? Yeah.
Well, I love the way you used your hands to do the circle, do glasses. Sorry, the audience can't see that.
Yeah.
That cool. Well, you know, it begins by helping people, especially Christians, get a sense of their story. As I always say, you know, most Christians never got the memo on their story of inclusion. They never got the memo that they were Gentiles. And one of the first things we have to do is to help Christians understand how it came to be that they are Christian, not just simply as a historical fact of God becoming flesh, but of us entering the story of another people, Israel, and learning who we are from inside the story of another people. The problem that then developed is Christians throughout our history, rejected what it meant to enter into another people's story. And we took over that story. And in effect, that is the origin of whiteness. That's the origin of the racial condition. At a particular moment in history, people from what we would now call Europe, when they came into contact with multiple different peoples around the world, they operationalized a way of seeing and a way of being that established the racial condition. And that grew out of believing that they were the people of God, having replaced Israel as the people of God. So we have to start by telling people that story, helping them understand how it creates the racial condition. And then we have to help them see one of the most important detrimental effects of that, which is to, when those Christian colonial settlers came across the planet, they took over the land and they separated people from land, which means they separated identity and told people that they carry their identities wholly on their body. And so the way in which we look at the world, the way in which we understand land, and the way in which we understand our bodies came to us, all of us as Christians, in a distorted way. And so we begin by storytelling. That's what I'm saying. We begin by storytelling so that people can understand what story they're actually inside of. Mm-hmm. And then what we do after we've started that storytelling, then we have a set of questions that we start to ask ourselves about who are we and where are we? And those two questions establish a different mission for every church. Who are we together and where are we together? And that's where we want to begin helping people start to address the racial condition. The race and the racial condition is tied inextricably to where we live and how we live. Race and geography are bound together. And so we have to get people to understand how they are bound together and how they work together. And that's crucial, because so much of our contemporary challenges, the racial challenges we face, are also geographic challenges. The challenges of place are also the challenges of race. Where we live is tied inextricably to how we live. And how we live is tied inextricably to how we understand who we are. And so we have to get people to see those connections.
So I live here down in the triangle of North Carolina, just outside of Durham, where you were for a time. Same with Adam. And I'm thinking about the dramatic changes of this area in just the past few years, as you're talking about geography. Raleigh and Durham are becoming really big tech hubs. And so there's an enormous influx of individuals from other nations traveling here, mm-hmm. and displacement and lots of communities being built. Mm-hmm. Lots of homes with nothing else. And so it's a blessing for me, because my children are in schools with other young children from all around the world, mm-hmm. and different languages. So I'm wondering about how an area like Raleigh-Durham, or like another smaller urban area in our country, as we continue to receive people from other nations and other faith traditions, I'm wondering how you see that impacting our understanding of our story. So when you're talking about geography affecting our faith, when geography is changing, how are you seeing those intersections influencing our understanding of Christianity? And
yeah, that's a great question, Amy. The difficulty in the Raleigh-Durham area, like so many other places in the country, is that we're all facing what I call the plague of gentrification. And so the positive of having people coming to places where they had not been before has to be balanced against what is often tied to that, which is horrible gentrification and people being pushed out, and we continuing to function in communities. And by we, I mean the real estate industry, the developers, the city planners, engineers, the managers, all these folks are functioning without any kind of moral compass. Mm. They are simply being driven by the market. And what is desperately needed in every town, this is a global problem, what's desperately needed is a moral compass to how we're building, where we're building, why we're building, and who can afford building. Homelessness is now becoming another virus. It's a global problem of people not having a place to live and people not being able to afford to live. But there is no moral compass being brought to real estate at all. It is being treated as though it's a natural phenomenon, like a hurricane, you know, or a tornado. Well, the prices just keep going up, you know, because unaffordable. What are we going to do about it? I said, well, there's a lot we can do about it. Prices don't have to go up. These things don't have to be. If a moral compass is tied to public policies that demand not simply affordable living, but living that shows some kind of moral character, right? And so Raleigh-Durham, like so many other communities, is facing a crisis of crisis, a moral crisis, not only in what's being built, but how it's being built. Is it being built to create community, or is it being built to simply create, continue to sustain the kind of class stratifications and segregations that mark this country? And that's a fundamental problem. And so what that means is that you might have pockets of diversity, but those pockets of diversity are in a sea of class and race stratification and segregation. And so it creates the conditions of blinding people to the moral bankruptcy of the very neighborhoods that they inhabit. Neighborhoods that don't have sidewalks, that don't have bus routes, where people can't get to. Neighborhoods that, you know, they know no one who makes less than deep into the six figures could ever afford a house here. Builders who build knowing that the starting price is going to be $700,000, $800,000, they know who will be able to buy that house and who won't. And housing for poor people that is limited or non-existent. And so all of these matters are crucial. And the challenge for churches is for us to become geographically aware and geographically involved. We need to be the people who bring a moral compass to development and to real estate and to talk about what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what is evil. And the way things are being built, there is something terribly wrong right now we know before the Supreme Court, there is a fight over whether we're going to criminalize homeless people for simply being places where they're not supposed to be. And the argument as it is now being presented is over whether cities have the right to move homeless people. But the argument is not over whether cities have responsibility to provide housing for everyone. The conversation is not about whether a country ought to have as a responsibility to provide housing for everyone. Franklin Delano Roosevelt at one point in time wanted to create another Bill of Rights for the American people. And what would be included in that Bill of Rights would have been the right to housing. The right to housing, as well as the right to health care. There is something deeply problematic with the idea that your health or your habitation have to be a calculus, an economic calculus, determined through an economic calculus. There's something deeply morally wrong about that. You should not have to pay to be healthy, nor should you have to pay to simply have a roof over your head. But now, what I've just said for so many people is just absolutely radical. How can they believe? Well, in point of fact, it's inherent to the gospel. The God who offers rain on the just and the unjust, sunshine on the just and the unjust, is housing the planet. And so those of us who follow that God become flesh have to understand that what's at stake in matters of housing and habitation is our discipleship. But too many churches continue to think of their discipleship as life inside a building with other people of like mind. And they don't think of their discipleship as tied inextricably to the neighborhoods they live in, the homes that they inhabit, the communities that they frequent. This is where their discipleship has to hit the ground. Now, this comes back to this, the big question about race, because this is the way racial antagonism is sustained in this country. As I've said many times, racial antagonism is not just a characteristic of life in America. It is a constituting reality of life in America. The pitting of white people against black people, the pitting of white people against all people of color, that's a part of the constituting reality. And it's sustained in part by geography. It's sustained by how we build communities. We always have to remember that all white or predominantly white communities never happen by accident. And that's the reality, the history of this country. They have never happened by accident. There has always been, since the founding of this country, an intentionality into how communities have been created. And an intentionality to sustaining white communities. And by sustaining white communities, I don't just mean communities that are just white. I mean that the community itself is always fundamentally controlled by white presence. And so we have to understand that that's not an act of nature or an act of God. It's an act of people. And unfortunately, economically, politically, socially, we have not had the will to challenge that. And churches have gone right along with this from the very beginning. In fact, in many communities, churches have been the anchor of the segregated ecologies of the Western world. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King Jr. said it so brilliantly decades ago, the most segregated hour in America is still 11 o'clock on Sunday. And so, and we have to understand that that's not by accident.
Well, I want to go back to your a question that you had growing up and that has continued to be a part of your mind, which is, does the gospel have the power to change us? And so what you're talking about suggests that Christianity for us, or our salvation, goes beyond just an individual, personal kind of salvation. We've made kind of salvation in Christianity all about the soul, or saving the soul, or, you know, going to heaven. And we've made it so personal and individualized. But what you're talking about is that the gospel calls us into the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The gospel calls us into social dimensions, into life together and the healing of the neighborhood. And I'm guessing you would say that the reason we've made in our, well, especially in predominantly white churches, made it very much about an individualistic faith, a personal faith, like faith is mine and personal and don't challenge me on, you know, it belongs to me, is a function of kind of the water we've grown up in, kind of this being able to separate ourselves and our spaces out from one another and try to make the gospel more personal to us, so that we don't have to deal with it, so that we don't have to deal with our neighborhood, so that we can remain separate, I guess, from each other. But how do we, if the gospel calls us into the neighborhood, into the social dimensions of life together and joining with others, why hasn't the church been able to catch up with what the Spirit is doing and once wanting to move us beyond our walls? Like, what are the barriers that are getting in the way of us being able to go beyond ourselves, go beyond our walls, and connect with others?
Well, so you're asking the right question. So most people these days would immediately understand what you've just said in terms of the problem of a Christianity that has been hyper-individualized. And so we need to move away from that and see Christianity as a communal calling. So most people would agree with that. It would, and most people, I'm sure if your listeners would be nodding their head and say, yeah, I've heard that before. What most people have not heard before is that we are inside of a long process of separating the body from land. And so we are living in the effects of that. Now, what does that mean? It gets back to something I said earlier, and I talk about this in The Christian Imagination, my book. When the Christian colonial settlers came, one of the first things they did, no matter what part of the world they came to, one of the first things they did was to separate indigenous people from the land. Because for so many indigenous peoples, no matter what peoples were talking about, they did not understand who they were apart from the land. And by land, I mean not just the land, I mean the water, I mean animals, I mean the sky. They both knew who they were in terms of their identity based on those places. And they were able to sustain a sense of who they are by being there. Now, both those things are important. At one level, it was being able to say, if you would ask, who are you? In many cases, as the missionaries' reports told us, you know, if they asked an indigenous person, who are you? They would tell some story, some long story that involved the land or the rocks or the sea or hunting or fishing or something. All that's just to tell you who they are. If they tell you their name is calibrated by the place. And so they would tell you who they are. And then their sense of themselves, how they came to know themselves, was dependent upon that place. But to make a long story short, these Christian colonial settlers, they wanted the land. And so their goal was to take as much of this land as possible. And to do that, it was to separate people, separate their sense of themselves from where they are. So what would that mean? It would mean that they would carry their identities wholly on their bodies, race, and that the land would be turned into property, private property. And so what that meant was that people in that way of thinking, people are separate from the land, even though they're on a land, they're actually separate from the land. The land really isn't alive and communicative and tied to their bodies, tied to them. It's just dirt. It's just property. And so that this way of thinking, which was pressed into the bodies and lives of indigenous peoples, was also pressed into the lives and the bodies of Christians. So what does that mean? It means that for so many Christians, so many Western people as well, more widely speaking, where we live in many ways is inconsequential to how we understand our life. That is to say, I can move from Fort Worth, Texas, to Portland, Oregon, to Grand Rapids, Michigan, to Durham, North Carolina, to New Haven, Connecticut. And, you know, one place is about the same as any other place. As long as I have my Starbucks, my grocery store, my Home Depot, I'll be okay. Because in a sense, I live on top of the land. I kind of move across the land. The anthropologist Tim Engle calls this inversion, where people think that they just kind of move on top of the land. I don't live in the land, in a place. And so what that means is that we inherited a Christianity that was formed inside that same distortion. So this gets back to what you said earlier. That means where we live and where our church exists are often not understood as a part of our discipleship. Mm-hmm. Our discipleship has to do with what we individually or even as a community do with one another. But where we live and where the church is has little to do with my discipleship, our discipleship. Now, what that means is that we are in a situation at this moment where it's very rare to find a church community where the people who attend the church live in the vicinity of the church. It's very rare to find a community where the people who live, who work, live, who go to a church, live in the vicinity of the church, and live out their discipleship in the very community where the church is at and where they live. And with that, what does that mean? It means that where our churches are, physically, actually, geographically, plays no role in the actual witness of our discipleship. And it is incredibly difficult for so many people to even get their minds around what I just said for two reasons. One, they don't see what difference that makes, which means that's already a fundamental problem. Number two, they wouldn't even know how to begin to rethink that condition. It gets back to what you mentioned earlier about people moving into a new area. People moving in, they find whatever house they can find. If they're Christian, they find some church wherever they want to go to. The church might be an hour away, 45 minutes away. It may be a church they join and they just come on Zoom on Sunday. That's all they do. And they're good people, good Christians. They love the Lord. They want to serve. They offer their money. They give their tithes. They do all the good things. But they are not connected in any way to the earth. They might have a garden, but they're not connected in any way to the earth, to other people. And so what I'm saying is that this is a fundamental distortion of our life. It's a fundamental distortion that we're not connected to a place. Now, the challenge is, I don't want individuals to run out and say, okay, I'm going to go and fix this myself. I want church communities to come together and start praying and asking God to show us how might we connect to the place that we're in a deep way. How might we, but it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, how might we put ourselves right inside the process that's all around us of gentrification, of real estate prices going wild, of development that has no moral compass at all, of builders and community developers and engineers and city managers and city governments that have no moral compass in their thinking about place at all? And how can we involve ourselves in creating a moral conversation, a conversation about how we ought to live as a people that not only makes affordable housing, that ends homelessness, but also ends the kinds of segregation and class stratifications that housing constantly nurtures? That's what we have to do, right? If we're serious about our discipleship, it's not just a question of us connecting with other people and understanding our salvation in terms of connecting with other people. That's right. But people are on the ground. And as long as we refuse to take the ground seriously, then our discipleship is always going to be hollow. And our ecclesiologies, the way we understand church, is always going to be vapid. It doesn't really matter. If place doesn't matter, then God's redemption of the world doesn't really matter. Because what we're saying is that God came to save a bunch of bodies and not the world. Just a bunch of bodies. Human bodies. Not even the other bodies. Now, of course, the good news in front of us is that, you know, a lot of people have become very much ecologically aware and are asking a whole new set of questions about what does the gospel have to say about ecology. And I'm glad they're asking that question, but they're often at the wrong end of the, they're kind of the wrong end of the stick asking the question. They're concerned about how we take better care of the land and everything as though it's property. So they think in terms of stewardship instead of thinking in terms of our deep connection to the world and the way we connect to one another through and in the world. Now, of course, all this comes back to race, because what I'm saying is that you cannot address in any substantial way the racial antagonism of the Western world until you face what I'm talking about now. We have to deal with where we live, how we live, and who we live with. We can't run from that and think we're going to address the racial antagonism of the Western world.
And we have to want it.
You have to want it, and you have to be intentional about it. But this is the most serious fight. As I go places and talk, if you really want to have a fight, show up at those meetings in every city with the city commissioners or whatever they're called and start talking about bus routes and property values and price points for new developments and where developments are going to be. And you want to fight? show up and start talking about that and start to say something about Jesus in those contexts. You will have a fight.
Yeah, the crazy thing about life now is that it can all be done online. Right. So I feel so disconnected, except people are all on Facebook about, you know, let's email the town manager and complain that our roads are too narrow and all those high school students are parking. And it's just this forum for online arguing without any kind of means of resolution, except it's very clear everybody would like all building to stop because we're good. So we don't really need anything more here. So just keep the problem there.
Which means that there, again, there's no ethical vision. There's no moral vision about what it means to build. And so it becomes a fight of convenience. What works best? A question of property values. And the most depressing thing to watch is a group of Christians in one of those meetings fighting over property values. Their Christianity, I've been to enough of those meetings where I watch people and they leave their Christianity at the door. When it comes to parking, roads, and bus routes, Christian, nothing. Here's what needs to happen. And so, you know, we what churches must do, and I also say this to colleges, but I certainly say this to churches, is that this is the one of the first places where we have to offer our witness. We need to show up in mass at those meetings and talk about life together. What's best for the flourishing of all people? Not property value, but let's talk about human value. But now, like I said, if you want to fight, you'll have a fight.
Yeah, because that's valuing something above everything else. Like that's valuing connecting with your neighborhood and joining with other people. That's saying if you're going to fight for that, it's saying I care about this above everything else.
And reconfiguring your neighborhood too. This is key. We have got to democratize the process of design. Right now, our communities are being created by just a few people. And in most places in this country, you don't even know who they are. But they're making the decisions that affect all of us. Where the sidewalks will be, where they won't be, where the stores will be, where the trees will be. They're making the decisions that affect us down to the bone. And we don't even know who they are. And the question, why should they be given that much power over the decisions that we all ought to be? But the problem is that many people, people don't, as I like to say, there are many people who they don't have the time or the energy to go to those meetings and fight for the common good. And so we who are Christian, we have to fight for the common good. We have to fight for bus routes and for sidewalks and for neighborhoods that are livable and for affordable housing and for the reconfigurations of neighborhoods so that they don't look like fortresses. And that will affect the kind of policing that we have because policing always follows zoning policy. And so how we shape a community is how we shape the behavior of the police. How we shape a community is how we shape the reality of care and nurture for everybody. And so we have to think about that. But these are theological matters. These are matters of discipleship. This is what I'm saying. And of course, it comes back to what we began talking today. And that is about race and how we address the racial condition. It's not about how an individual feels in their heart toward another, a racial other, though that might be a part of it. It's first about how the community is configured to make possible a new life together. And if the community is configured to make that impossible, then we can have all the good feelings that we want in our heart, but the very community is shaped to keep it from happening.
We have to care about those relationships and care about coming into contact and building our cities and our neighborhoods so that we'll come in contact with one another and not so we'll be. So we're valuing that over safety and protection and trying to wall ourselves off from each
Right.
other. So it's like a different set of values for how we structure our neighborhoods and cities.
We have to understand that we've inherited structures that structure fear into our communities, that structure hatred into our communities, that structure distrust into our communities. These things are structured, right? And so you can reverse that so that the first question is not safety. The first question is how do we create communities in which trust is built into the very way the community is shaped? Bodies, as I like to say, bodies, buildings, and design are intertwined. And the problem is that we have used the idea of safety as an alibi to allow real estate and developers to do nefarious things in the name of safety. If I have you afraid, I can get a, if I can get you afraid, do a lot of things that you will allow me to do. I could build a lot of very ugly buildings. I can configure neighborhoods and communities in distorted and ugly ways simply because I can say this will keep you safer. I can build walls. I can build roads. I can build communities in which there is not a sidewalk to be found. I can build bus routes that would never go anywhere near neighborhoods, all in the name of safety. And I can convince you that what is ugly is actually beautiful because it keeps you safe. When in point of fact, all is done is structure fear into the very fabric of your community, which will work itself down into your soul. It's why in many communities, parents won't even, they could be cul-de-sacs, a suburb cul-de-sacs. There are communities where parents won't even let their kids ride a bike in the community. That's how afraid they are. It could be a suburban cul-de-sac and they still won't let their kids go outside and walk around the community because they're that scared. And you understand that level of fear gets down into the bones of a kid.
I'm wondering about what is the goal to which we are heading. What are we striving for ultimately? We've talked a little bit about restructuring neighborhoods, and for churches that are wondering what we can do, I think you've mentioned, praying together about how we can be located in a place. About how we can understand the land in which we're situated, showing up at town hall or city hall meetings. What is the vision for which we're chasing? What's the goal for which we're chasing? And how will we know when we get there? What does it look like?
That's a great question. So I always come back when it comes to these matters to the book of Acts. And what we know about the coming of the Spirit is that the Spirit is always drawing us into the lives of people we prefer not to be drawn into. The Spirit is trying to create this diverse community where people love one another. So the end game, what we're going for, is a witness to the presence of the Spirit of God in us as a community, by how we are gathering together people different from us in love, that we are revealing a life of surprising love for people different from us. So I always say to when I go places and talk, I always say, and I've never been wrong about this, and I've never been wrong about this. I always say, if any church, and even any individual as well, if you pray as a church, Lord, show us the people who you want us to grow close to that we have been trying to avoid. It has never been the case that the Spirit of God has not immediately told the leadership of a church the exact people or an individual, because most people pass them every day. And most people know that the Spirit is tapping them on the shoulder and say, okay, you see those folk over there that you keep driving by every day? Those are the people I want you to get to know. And so all I want are for churches to pray that they would yield to the Spirit of God, in whom the Spirit of God wants us as a community to get to know, to join, to be a part of. And that doesn't mean to try to assimilate them into us. It means to become a part of their lives, share in their lives and their needs, their wants, not to treat them like they're objects of missionary operations, but that this is life together. And so what the end game for every church ought to be, a community. They ought to be a community that draws community, that creates community with diverse people. And the effect of that church in a community is that it's a constant pull. It's like a magnet pulling people deeper connection to the earth and to one another. That's what ought to be the case. And unfortunately, so many people run from that. But here's the good news I want us to end with. The good news is that the Spirit of God is unrelenting because God is gracious. And so God never gives up on calling us to communion with God and with the land and with one another. God never gives up. And so if we ever yield to the Spirit, then the power to change, the power to do things different is right there. So in many ways, I'm living toward the answer I was seeking as a young man. Is there the power to change? I thought, yes, it's there. There is the power to change. But we have to yield to the Spirit. And the change is not something that happens and then we walk away because we've been changed. The change is a way of life. We live in the change. And that's what we're talking about. It's not easy to oppose the way in which property and land functions in the Western world. But you can live toward the change. You can. And that's what we want. We want people to live toward the change.
Well, Dr. Jennings, I'm so glad that you yielded to the Spirit and that you were asking those questions early on in life. And I'm so grateful that you, one of my favorite professors, who really made me ask some hard questions about the land, about the built environment, and about myself. Those questions that live in my body. But I'm so grateful that you call us to answer, to ask those challenging questions and to help us explore these things, and that God has more to offer us. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much again for taking the time to be with us and just for being who you are and for your work.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Thank you, friends, for being with us for this incredible conversation with Dr. Jennings. I felt so strengthened and challenged by the witness of Dr. Jennings in the way that he could take difficult questions and present them in a new lens. Adam, what are you taking away?
I was struck by how our conversation really took a turn from talking about the individual dimensions of discipleship and the ways that we confront racism within ourselves into more social dimensions, and how our discipleship or living out the gospel, it does require us to do that hard sort of internal work that we all have to do in our bodies, in our minds, you know, prejudices that we've inherited or have to deal with within ourselves. But at some point, the gospel calls us to come out of ourselves and to go out into the neighborhood and to start asking hard questions about how our neighborhoods and how our communities are structured, and working towards neighborhoods and sidewalks and bus routes and the ways that our cities and towns are structured so that we're coming into contact with one another
It's sort of an ethos of planning your neighborhood where you want to join with other people. It's an ethos of trust. And I was just struck by the social dimension that clearly seems to be something he's really thinking about a lot today. So that's what I'm taking away from today's conversation. What about you?
Yeah, he had clearly been reflecting on many of those thoughts already. So it was an honor to catch him midstream and join in those reflections. I was really taken by the clarity of his call as a young person and how he was asking questions and pursuing deep topics at a very young age. And it was that drive to understand that helped him to know ultimately where he was heading with his vocation and his calling. And it really inspired me to pay more attention to the questions that our young people are asking. How can we take these complex issues and empower young people to ask questions and to help us ultimately understand our own viewpoints? So I am really grateful that he was able to narrate his upbringing and how that has set him up so well to live into the gifts he was given.
Yeah, he's somebody who clearly had a lot of questions as a kid and wrestled with a lot of things in his city and in his church. And I'm sure, you know, he's, as he was kind of saying, he's the kind of kid that every pastor says they love to have around. And then quietly they're like, ah, that kid, he just won't stop asking me questions.
I thought I answered it. Yeah, and calls them out when they answer differently than the last time or contradict themselves. So, yeah, I'm grateful for those that were responsive to him from a young age.
Yeah, it was a deep and rich conversation. I'm glad that we were able to have it, able to talk with him. And friends, we're grateful that you were able to join in this conversation. Join us next time on Call. This podcast is produced and edited by me, Adam Benson, and the Reverend Amy Stewart. It is sponsored by Metkin Abbey in Monk's Corner, South Carolina. And the music is a royalty-free, no copyright mandolin music from Laborio Conti.